Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
From Rockefeller Center, ladies and gentlemen, New York City, spitting distance from Lorne Michaels. No, of course I'm not. It is the final few hours, as you're being reminded incessantly of this incessant, unending presidential election campaign. And the last debate is up now for you to see. The one that really, really makes a difference. I mean, let's just remember, shall we, that if the words spoken by the ultimate victor in the 2000 election were to be believed, the United States has been pursuing a humble foreign policy the past 8 years. So the words probably don't matter this time around, too. Hence, the only debate that really counts, the silent debate between Barack Obama and John McCain at MyDamnChannel.com right now. But, well, you could go right now because it's silent, but don't. Stay with me here for the next hour or so. It is indisputable, ladies and gentlemen, that whoever wins the presidency is not to be envied. He is inheriting the biggest crap pile ever dumped on a White House desk in modern memory. And by day two, half the country or more is going to be saying, see, what did he expect? So it's not, you know, again, you have to wonder about just the people who want this job. The mind of the host of this program does go back to one fact that stands out for me. A little more than 3 years ago, the greatest engineering disaster since Chernobyl, according to one expert, occurred in the city of New Orleans, blamed by three different teams of investigators on misfeasance and malfeasance by an agency of the United States federal government. Not a word about it in this presidential campaign. It didn't happen. We dreamed it. It must have dreamed it down there. Not a word. Why? No, not evil. Not malice, not any of that good stuff. You and I know the reason, ladies and gentlemen. It didn't show up in the polls. The candidates decide what to talk about based on what people in the polls say they're concerned about. And it wasn't even in the top 10. So, you know, I don't care whether you vote or not. It's no skin off any part of my anatomy. But I will say this. If you are going to some place on Tuesday and you're going behind a little curtain and you're casting what you think will be a secret ballot, and you then decide, the minute you leave that little private booth, to go out and talk to a total stranger and tell him how you voted, how much money you make, and what religion you are, just make sure that when he asks what demographic group you belong to, you say, genius. Hello, welcome to the show.
And the rubbish tip makes a valid form of
From the Big Apple, from Manhattan, from Rockefeller Center. Wow. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. Dear Harry, I don't think you've been making sufficient note of the difficulty selecting an antenna or the potential additional costs in real numbers or numbers relative to the cost of the converter box for an antenna capable of receiving the same number of channels digitally as the old rabbit ears. This is from a listener called Alan. My mom lives in Middle Georgia, he writes, and receives TV from three different cities in three different directions. Uh-oh, I know where this is going. She asked me for help in selecting an antenna to receive digital TV. She wants to be in the digital wonderland, I guess. I found the process a little confusing, writes Alan, and it looks like the antenna she needs will cost around $120, and it is a big directional antenna. It needs to be installed and may need a rotator so it can be pointed as appropriate for one of the three different stations. I would recommend that she get cable, but they won't run cable out to where she lives. Alan, ladies and gentlemen, weighing in on the digital wonderland. Because it is a wonderland. They couldn't call it that if it wasn't that, you know. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
With apologies to the Daily Beast, Tina Brown's web magazine from which I borrowed this feature. Oh, no, they borrowed it from me. That's right. Here, first of all, there's so many apologies connected to this one incident. A British talk show host, Jonathan Ross, and a British comedian, Russell Brand. Both of them have radio shows as well. Radio? Why would you do radio? And they were ticked off because an actor, Andrew Sachs, who was famous in Fawlty Towers, didn't come on as they thought he was going to. So they left messages on his answering machine suggesting that Russell Brand, this comedian, had been having his way with Mr. Sachs's granddaughter and then played those messages on the radio. Here is the Director General of the BBC, Mark Thompson.
I would like to add my own personal and unreserved apology to Andrew Sachs, his family, and to licence fee payers for the completely unacceptable broadcast on BBC Radio 2. BBC audiences accept that, in comedy, performers attempt to push the line of taste. However, this is not a marginal case. It is clear from the views expressed by the public that this broadcast has caused severe offence, and I share that view.
His words were read by an actor. I guess, just like the former head of the IRA, you're not allowed to hear his voice on the air. Comedian Russell Brand resigned from his Radio 2 program following those prank calls. It followed a public apology from Jonathan Ross. Once called the David Letterman of England, he was getting paid $9 million, ladies and gentlemen, a year for doing one show a week. That makes him smarter than David Letterman. Followed a public apology from Ross over his, quote, juvenile and thoughtless remarks in the calls. The pair are suspended and their shows taken off the air until the BBC has investigated. And the BBC apologized to Andrew Sachs for unacceptable and offensive messages left by Russell Brand and Jonathan Ross on the former Fawlty Towers star answer phone. But, you know, all the apologies aren't in England. The United States Army has apologized. Dateline Chicago, an 84-year-old Illinois man, says the U.S. Army has apologized for wrongfully targeting him for a court-martial 64 years ago and given him back pay. Roy Montgomery of Park Forest, Illinois, said receiving two checks totaling $42,254 from the Army for service back pay and a formal apology from an Army official was a welcome relief after more than six decades. This is a great satisfaction, Montgomery said after receiving the Army offerings this week. Now I can forget about the whole thing. That's all I ever wanted to do. He was one of 28 soldiers convicted in relation to a 1944 riot on an Army base in Seattle that resulted in an Italian prisoner's death. Allegations of racism immediately followed the trials of the 43 total soldiers accused in the case, as the only troops convicted were black. That doesn't happen. The Army Board of Review overturned those convictions last year in light of new evidence, and Montgomery, the last known survivor in the case, received back pay and an apology. Dateline, California, a Halloween display featuring a Confederate flag and a noose at a campus residence of California Polytechnic University, San Luis Obispo, Cal Poly, we call it, has outraged students and faculty. The display popped up at the university-owned Crops House, where six horticulture students live. Yes, you can, but you can't make them think. Crop Science Department Chief John Peterson says he met with the students and told them, "We are truly repulsed by it." The students have apologized in writing. Cal Poly President Warren Baker says in a statement that the display reflected a shameful period of American history. The university says the students have a right to free speech, and they aren't being punished. Just shamed on a national radio broadcast. Dateline, suburban St. Louis. A widow recovering from cancer surgery was wheeled into the Schrader Funeral Home on a recent Sunday afternoon for her husband's wake. She looked into the casket and without hesitation said, quote, "That's not my Fritz," unquote. Her husband of 52 years, Frederick M. Fritz Schnabel, no relation, I don't know, had died of pneumonia at a nursing home 6 days earlier. The man in the casket was wearing his signature dark green suit and large wire-rimmed glasses, but he didn't have the Schnabel family nose or this particular individual's silver-white hair. The 15 relatives in the room were aghast. The widow was in tears. "He had Fritz's clothes on," said son-in-law Chuck Schreiber of Fort Wayne, Indiana. The confusion started right there. It was a funeral home mix-up. Schrader Funeral Home had mistakenly buried the 80-year-old Schnabel 3 days earlier under the name Robert J. Leonard, who died the same day but in a different nursing home. "They tried to fix us. They tried to convince us they can just fix it, said one of Schnabel's two daughters. I said, "No, this isn't Dad." We had to try to convince the funeral home it wasn't Dad. That was the hardest part. Finally, scars were used to identify the correct person. The funeral home declined to talk to the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, but the firm said Schrader deeply regrets the extraordinary mistake, the first of its kind in the funeral home's 140-year history. It also refunded the cost of both funerals, and it has implemented a new rule. Bodies must have ID tags. That's a relief. Janet Jackson decided to cut a racy segment from her concert in Detroit this week to comply with a Michigan state law that prohibits simulated sex acts in a public performing space. The Palace of Auburn Hills, why, that's where the Pistons play. Simulated basketball. No, just... The Palace approached Jackson's camp with concerns about the three-song discipline segment. An arena spokesman said, "We explained the law, asked her not to do it. She complied." Jackson's manager said in a statement, "Janet did not want to disappoint her Detroit area fans again, so we adhered to Michigan State ordinance and trimmed the segment so it would not be canceled." During the segment in question, Jackson, when she's not in Michigan, pulls a male fan from the crowd, ties him down, and molests him, in quotes, while her dancers mime various sexual acts. During her encore at the Palace of Auburn Hills, Jackson apologized for cutting the law-breaking portion of the concert, telling the 8,000 fans in the 21,000-seat venue, talk about burying the lead, "We hope you enjoyed the show we gave you." Dateline Chicago, distraught track star Marion Jones says she often thinks she would have won gold medals at the 2000 Sydney Olympics even if she hadn't taken a designer steroid known as the Clear. "I ask myself, well, if you hadn't been given the Clear, do you think you would have won?" Jones said on Oprah, well, on the Oprah show. "I usually answer yes." On the show, Jones once again apologized to her Olympic teammates and tearfully read a letter she wrote in prison in which she told her children she lied to federal prosecutors because she didn't love herself enough to tell the truth. So, yes, the new penalty for perjury to federal officials, you will be sentenced to love yourself. In public, Jones described how prosecutors showed her a vial of a designer steroid and asked if she'd taken it. She said she immediately recognized it as a substance her former coach gave her, but then lied. "I made the decision I was going to lie and try to cover it up." She maintained she thought the substance was flaxseed oil when her coach gave it to her, but later learned from prosecutors it was the designer steroid. Last week, a federal judge sentenced her trainer to a year of home confinement for lying to federal investigators. Well, I hope he loves himself there. But there's TV to watch. You may not have time for self-love. Dateline Washington Democratic Representative John Murtha apologized this week for saying his home base in western Pennsylvania is racist in the course of talking about Obama's prospects for winning the state. You may recognize this. This is not the first time Murtha made that statement and delivered this apology. In a statement issued by his office, the congressman said, "I apologize for making the comment that western Pennsylvania is a racist area." He was criticized by Republicans. He is, of course, a Democrat. What else is new? Except he's done it again. Probably do it after the election is over. The SoapNet cable channel, a cable channel devoted to
my stories, I have to go home and watch my stories,
apologized this week for using a photo of a murdered 6-year-old boy as a prop on its show General Hospital Night Shift. Who knew? See? It's a learning experience, this show. I mean, this show. This one right here. Who knew that there was a show called General Hospital Night Shift? Well, the women who go home
to watch my stories.
Christopher Barrio's picture appeared when a character played by Billy D. Williams, interesting, looked at a photo of a son he'd abandoned. "That baby made the world to us." Oh, sorry. "That baby made..." I thought this was dialogue from the show. No, this is actual dialogue from a living person. "That baby meant the world to us, and people don't have the right to do this kind of stuff," Barrio's grandmother, Sue Rodriguez, said. ABC, which produces the show for the SoapNet network, called the photo's appearance a terrible error, apologized, and said, "It is investigating." And you know, ABC has a fine investigative unit. A former Pennsylvania Supreme Court justice is apologizing after her signature was on an email message to Jewish voters that likened a vote for Barack Obama to ignoring warning signs that led to the Holocaust. In an email this week, Sandra Schultz Newman said the email was misguided. We need better guided emails. NASA is working on that right now, I think. And she regrets she did not carefully review the final draft before it was released. Maybe we all need a send button lock. The email was sent to 75,000 Jewish voters in Pennsylvania. GOP officials said they never approved the email, and the political consultant who wrote it was fired. Schultz and names of two other McCain supporters were on the email. But wait, there's more. Faced with a spike in street robberies, Palo Alto, California Police Chief Lynn Johnson is under fire after revealing at a meeting that she instructed officers to stop African Americans and, quote, find out who they are. We do not want to create an environment of fear for people of color in this community. Absolutely not, Johnson said at a community meeting this week. But on the other hand, we do have to do due diligence in trying to apprehend the suspects who are doing this. In an interview with the San Jose Mercury News, she said her remarks were misinterpreted. She apologized in particular for her comments about stopping anyone, quote, wearing a do-rag, unquote. She denied instructing her officers to make stops based on race. We do not racially profile in Palo Alto, she told the newspaper. We are very sensitive to that. We have a policy that prohibits it. We were one of the first departments to put cameras in our cars. We collect demographic data and put it on our website. We do not condone racial profiling in any way. I haven't actually instructed my officers in this regard at all. She added, they know what to do. And finally, the Pittsburgh Steelers issued a statement by wide receiver Santonio Holmes, who was deactivated by his coach before last Sunday's loss to the New York Giants after he was charged with marijuana possession. I would like to apologize to my teammates, the Steelers organization, my family, and the fans for my actions that caused me to miss Sunday's game. The statement read, I recognize that I made a mistake and understand the significance of my actions and will not make any excuses for my behavior. I look forward to putting this behind me and to being accepted by my teammates and fans as part of the team. No word whether he's playing in today's game. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen. An oh-so-copyrighted feature of this very broadcast. And, no, I'm over here. Don't worry about me. I'm right over here doing something important because it's time for another copyrighted feature we have not heard for a long time on this program. And yet, it all continues. Tales of Airport Security, won't you? I don't think Tina Brown's website has stolen this one yet. Tina, this one's good too. Dear Harry, I was flying I don't think we want to hear that yet. Dear Harry, I was flying out of Philadelphia a couple weeks ago, and as I was emptying my pockets of metal, realized I still had my pocket knife with me, which has a 3-inch blade. I threw it in my backpack and put my two bags on the X-ray belt. I was promptly summoned to the side desk, and both of my bags were carefully inspected while I put my shoes back on. I held my breath as the lady laid open my backpack and with her blue rubber gloves immediately picked up my knife. She held it up and looked carefully at it and, to my amazement, put it back down. Then she rooted through the bag for a while and announced she would have to have it rescreened, which she did. After some discussion, it was brought back to the table where we reenacted the earlier scene. She picked up the knife, looked carefully at it, and then put it back down. Then she told me that they were actually looking for a wrench. After some thought, I realized that, yes, I had slipped a small crescent wrench into my bag a couple of weeks earlier and forgotten about it. I told her where to find it. And after confirming that it was indeed less than 8 inches in size, she smiled, handed me my bags with all their contents, and sent me off to the plane. I mailed the knife home from my home in from Phoenix, where I was visiting the very next day. I should note that during this long inspection process, my Egyptian travel companion Ahmed, saw what was going on and promptly made himself scarce, assuming that the last thing I needed was for the authorities to know that I was accompanied by someone with a non-Anglo name. Tales of airport security, ladies and gentlemen. That is a copyrighted feature of this broadcast so far. But you never know when copyright runs out. Now, ladies and gentlemen, just 15 months after being forced to resign as president of the World Bank over a conflict of interest regarding his professional and personal relationship with his girlfriend, Shahariza, former Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz may be back in the news again. It involves his dual roles as chairman of the State Department's International Security Advisory Board. Did you know that? And chairman of the U.S.-Taiwan Business Council. He's a busy guy, the Wolf. The latter, that business council's members, are military contractors who've been dying to get the Bush administration's approval to sell about $11 billion worth of arms to Taiwan to protect it against a threat of an attack from China. This is from Asia Times. Condi Rice appointed Wolfowitz as chairman of the Arms Control Advisory Panel in January of this year. Wolfowitz's appointment, after coming after his disgrace at the bank, was seen as a kind of token public redemption that would presumably have little consequence in actual policy terms. A premature assumption, perhaps, because judging by an article appearing in the Washington Times, Wolfowitz's advisory board may be trying to gin up tensions with China, acting as a new Team B in persuading policymakers and the public at large that Beijing's military modernization is more threatening to the U.S. than many current government and private sector analyses suggest. That's based on a draft of an advisory board report that, according to the Washington Times, is out in a few weeks. The board recommends that the U.S. obtain new offensive space and cyber warfare capabilities and missile defenses, as well as more robust sea and space-based capabilities to deter any crisis over Taiwan. Unquote. Maybe Kimoi and Matsu, too. Until now, Washington has assured China that its missile defense efforts were directed solely against rogue states like North Korea and Iran. But that may be changing. The report also predicts China will have more than 100 nuclear missiles capable of reaching the U.S. by 2015, compared to only 20 at the present time. To avoid an emerging missile creep by China toward the U.S. will need to pursue new missile defense capabilities, the report asserts. And it also asserts the pivotal importance of Taiwan in all of this. If China is to become a global power, says the advisory board, on which Wolfowitz is a member, as well as helping out his friends in Taiwan, the first step must include control of the island, taking over the island, blah, blah, blah. China views Taiwan as central to the legitimacy of the regime and key to projecting its power throughout the world. Ladies and gentlemen, the Wolf is still on the run.
A thinking man's fighter, a warrior's bigger bark. Iraq was what he wanted, and he wouldn't leave a mark. He knew nothing of the country. He spoke with iron will. They had no ethnic conflict.
This is Le Show from New York City. Think of it. Imagine the fun. And now, ladies and gentlemen.
He's not a general.
He commands no troops.
He's not an inspector.
He peeks at no stoops.
He's an inspector general. Oh, yeah.
On any given day in Iraq, about 140,000 Iraqi soldiers are on duty. But some 1,000 are in jail, 2,000 are in the hospital, around 1,000 are absent without leave, though all are counted as part of the Iraqi army that's supposed to one day replace ours. You know, ours? Nobody, in fact, is exactly sure how many Iraqis are actually on duty, partly due to problems with a government contract designed to count the soldiers, according to a recent audit. As a result, 5 years into the war, the U.S. still doesn't know how many Iraqis are actually ready to do the army thing. There were problems, and there still are problems, says Stuart Bowen, the Special Inspector General for Iraq. We're hopeful, but it's self-evident it'll take a whole lot of time to work its way out. The audit that Bowen released earlier this month, actually last month now, confront two crucial issues. How many Iraqi troops are on duty, and how well does the government control the contracts it has issued? Figures submitted in October show that about 64% of the 140,000 supposed Iraqi soldiers are present for duty. Another 24% are on approved leave. The rest are in jail, on medical leave, absent, or simply unaccounted for. This is not a perfect science, says Chief of Staff for the advisory team to the U.S. training mission. It's not a perfect headcount. That's why we're trying to improve the system. I wish them good luck. I think it's a good system to improve. My personal opinion. A U.S. contractor hired to teach Iraqis about good government misplaced $185,000 in cash, then claimed the loss as an expense. The U.S. government not only covered the loss, but paid the contractor tens of thousands of dollars more in special fees for overhead and other costs related to the missing money, according to that same Special Inspector General for Iraqi Reconstruction, which questions this decision. His auditors couldn't figure out whether the U.S. government got what it paid for in two huge contracts, valued at almost $600 million to help Iraqis work on building local government, partly because no process was put in place for laying out objectives and assessing success. Why do you need that? What are you looking at? During the first 4 years of the contract, In other words, auditors tend to think the contractor are making progress with the governance program, but they can't prove it. Oversight of the contracts has now been improved. As to the missing cash, during its work, this particular institute lost $185,000. And with the agreement of the State Department, thank you, Condi, the institute claimed the loss as an expense. The institute also got an extra $57,000 in fees for administering the contracts. Bowen's, the Special Inspector General's office said it had no details on how or where the money was lost. Well, of course, that's why it's lost. And the institute and in question and U.S. aid didn't immediately provide an explanation. Officials say it all might be legal. Well, yeah. Why not? But there's more from the Inspector General. Busy time for these guys and gals. A huge American-financed wastewater treatment plant in the desert city of, say it with me now, Fallujah, which the United States troops assaulted twice in 2004, was supposed to be a centerpiece of an effort to rebuild Iraq. Instead, the project, which has tripled in costs from original plans to $100 million and fallen 3 years behind schedule, has become an example of the failed and often oversold program to rebuild Iraq's infrastructure with American dollars and skill. Dollars, I understand. What's the project was so poorly conceived that there is no reliable electricity to run pumps and purification tanks, no money left to connect homes to the main sewer lines, which now run uselessly beneath Fallujah's streets, good skateboard tracks, according to a report by federal investigators. Again, the same special investigator, Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction. A busy, busy office. It stopped short of saying the officials with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, which has primary responsibility for the project. Well, you can stop right there. Take the rest of the day off, Inspector General. Or the American Embassy's own Reconstruction Bureau deliberately withheld information on the problems, but the IG's office determined that senior officials at the embassy and the Army Corps knew of problems for years without taking them to the American ambassador or including them in any of the State Department's reports, which are supposed to inform Congress of the status of taxpayer-financed projects in Iraq. When our ambassador learned about the problems in July, he asked the investigators to determine why he had never been informed. There were, it turned out, systematic barriers to reporting reconstruction failures up the chain of command, possibly helping to explain why senior embassy and military officials often praise projects that later turned out to be flawed are non-functional. And the Army Corps has repeatedly promoted the Fallujah project as a remarkable success in its news releases on Iraqi reconstruction. We are all New Orleans. We may not all be Joe the Plumber, ladies and gentlemen, but it looks like we're all New Orleans. In April, for example, an Army Corps release said the project had been started in May 2007 and would eventually serve all the homes in Fallujah. In fact, the project was begun in 2004, and was originally supposed to have been finished 18 months later. At its earliest, it'll be finished partly by next April, and while the original plan called for the plant to cover the entire city, it has been since downsized to serve at most one-third of the population. But that's just water treatment. Who cares about that? $1.08 of the $48 billion paid out by U.S. taxpayers to rebuild Iraq since the invasion was spent on private bodyguards, said the same inspector. Take the rest of the week off, Stuart. Nearly $6 billion for Iraqi reconstruction was actually spent on private security companies hired to guard officials and workers. The security costs went largely unnoticed because there was no requirement that government agencies keep tabs on them. Because there was no requirement to track these costs, it was not completely clear for several years that security costs were consuming large portions of reconstruction budgets, says the IG. It is now clear these costs were extremely high. Hey, it's a war. What do you want? Also, from the same office, Stuart, take the month off. The Defense Department terminated more than 1,200 Iraq reconstruction contracts since the invasion, worth a combined $1 billion, before they were completed. Waste can result if projects are terminated prior to completion and not subsequently completed or used, said the Inspector General. For these projects, millions of dollars have been wasted. Many of the contracts terminated for default were due to poor performance by contractors, although no suspension actions were taken against those failed contractors. It's an accountability moment. News from our inspectors general, ladies and gentlemen. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And because we may not be able to enjoy this song again, either she'll be forgotten or she'll have assumed all of Dick Cheney's powers. One more time for The Bridge to Nowhere.
I'm asleep, you're in every dream, but can you be as grand as you seem? You span the miles, why I really don't know. You promise a journey, but where do you go? Walls, I would dwell.
Bridge to nowhere.
Please set me free. Oh, how I wonder how you feel about me. First, I loved you. I thought you could help cut short my commute to the moose and the elk. But you became a notorious curse. My dreams are driving right into reverse. You're under my skin when my world is at stake. Forsaking you is no sin. Just leave me alone. We'll keep the money. Honey, you're on your own.
To the bridge.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, news from outside the bubble. Right here. First, from the Australian newspaper, Rupert Murdoch says victory for Barack Obama may be a setback for globalization. But the interesting thing about this article is, according to Murdoch, he says Obama's promises to give tax rebates to 95% of Americans was, quote, rubbish, as, quote, quoting Rupert Murdoch, 40% of the U.S. population don't pay taxes, unquote. Rupert Murdoch, man who knows the people. But also, from The Guardian in London, a newly disclosed memo from Tony Blair's archives has revealed how Blair helped Rupert Murdoch overcome an official investigation which was jeopardizing one of his big investments. Blair ordered his top officials to help Murdoch, who was frustrated that a potentially lucrative scheme was being blocked by a long-running European investigation. Blair told Murdoch he was, quote, instinctively sympathetic to what Murdoch was aiming to achieve. Murdoch eventually won approval for the plan, an interactive scheme in which people could shop and manage their finances through their televisions. This is a year after Murdoch endorsed Tony Blair and successfully claimed to have achieved Blair's election as a result. By the way, the interactive television project performed well, but by 2001 it collapsed as people found it easier to shop on the internet. Well, good try. Ultimately, the Guardian, Royal Bank of Scotland, which is being bailed out with $30 billion of taxpayers' money, has signaled it's preparing to pay large bonuses to thousands of staff, just like in this country. The bank has set aside, about $3 billion to cover staff costs, including discretionary bonuses, at its investment banking division for the first 6 months of this year alone. They were doing very well this first 6 months of this year, weren't they? Oh, no. It was that same division caused a $8 billion write-down that wiped out the bank's profits for the same period. It's an accountability moment. The government has demanded, the British government, that directors at the banks should not receive bonuses. Its chief executive is leaving without a payoff. But below the boardroom level, banks are preparing to pay big bonuses to investment bankers who continue to generate profits. But you may be wondering, as the Iraq War disappears or fades from American view at this point in time, what's ever happened to Ahmed Chalabi, the guy who sold us the war in the first place? This is such an interesting story, ladies and gentlemen. It's, of course, from outside the bubble. Iraq's former deputy premier says that the controversial security deal, you know, the one that we've been trying to negotiate with the Iraqi government to keep our troops there legally, would divide the Iraqi people. Who is that former deputy premier? Ahmed Chalabi. He says the, quote, divisive agreement, unquote, would also be considered as a black record in his country's history. Where does this report come from? It comes from the Iranian news service. Chalabi, who once was alleged to have ties to Iranian intelligence, ladies and gentlemen. At least some country has intelligence. Chalabi said even after signing the agreement, there would be no guarantee that Iraq would be dealt with in accordance with the UN Charter. He says the State of Forces Agreement would not determine whether U.S. could hire people who might be involved in activities against a friendly country. I wonder which friendly country he has in mind. He says the new agreement would allow the U.S. to use its military bases in Iraq in a war with another country. I wonder which country he has in mind. Again, the story from Iranian news service. The Saudi daily newspaper, Okaz, that's, I guess, Saudi for okay, disclosed that the agreement includes some secret provisions which even Iraqi lawmakers are unaware of. These secret provisions would allow the U.S. to refuse to withdraw its troops from Iraq for as long as we wish. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
Thank you. Giving me the time to learn, I want to thank you for letting me burn all those bridges. Let me thank you for knowing that it wouldn't be my day. Cause you may lose your mind and you may lose your way, but this is the pursuit of happiness.
sink lower than I should have. Thank you for knowing that the pain would do me good. Thank you for knowing that I would be understood someday. Cause you might lose your mind and you might lose your way. This is the pursuit of happiness. So Mother Mercy, hear your daughter. I'm a baby in the bulrush. I'm a ship out of water. Don't you know that I'm done denying? I'm crying with laughter. So come on, smother me.
This is Le Show, and now, news of the warm, won't you? Make it shake, baby.
Soft, listen to the warm.
Global warming is making the sea more salty, according to new research that demonstrates the massive shifts in natural systems triggered by climate change. Experts at Reading University say warmer temperatures over the Atlantic Ocean have significantly increased evaporation and reduced rainfall across a giant stretch of water from Africa to the Caribbean in recent years. The change concentrates salt in the water and is predicted to make southern Europe and the Mediterranean much drier in the future. The moisture is being evaporated and transported to higher latitudes. Well, that's more salt for all of us, isn't it? Is that a good thing? You would have thought. Now, if we can find some way to get more pepper into the oceans, we'll have a full meal. News of the Warm, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. That's going to put the backwards cap on this edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe on the USEN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world to the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.4 and 5 megahertz, on the mighty 104 in Berlin, on XM and Sirius satellite radio, around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archive whenever you want it. HarryShearer.com and KCRW.com, available as a free download to members at www.audible.com/the show, and available as a free podcast at KCRW.com. and be just like, somebody remembering something happened somewhere down south 3 years ago, if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you already? Thank you very much. Uh-huh. The email address for this broadcast and the playlist of music featured here on is always at the ever-evolving harryshearer.com, a typical show chapeau to the San Diego, Chicago, Pittsburgh, and Hawaii desks, and to Lonnie Rosenbaum for helping to make today's program possible. And thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. So long from New York City. And from New York State. And New York State FM.